Welcome to the Being Human podcast, brought to you by Relate Malaysia. Join us in our conversations about what makes us human and why we think and behave in the ways that we do. We'll talk about mental health, emotional well-being, and how we can sometimes feel on top of the world, and other times like life calls for a large tub of ice cream and a big spoon. So come on in, relax, and let's explore this puzzle of being human together.
Hello and welcome to the 50th episode of the Being Human podcast. My name is Dr. Chua Suk Ning, and over the past 3 years, I've had the privilege and pleasure of having conversations with eminent psychologists and mental health advocates who are passionate about helping people to live meaningful lives through gaining a better understanding of what it means to be human. We've covered a broad range of topics and conversations with a wide range of guests, each offering unique perspectives and insights that have added to our understanding of important mental health discussions. And hopefully these discussions have also taught us how we can contribute to the ongoing progress of making education, training, and mental health support and services available to everyone at the point of need. This has always been at the heart of Relate Malaysia's mission, and it's been great to have the continuing support of so many people along the way, which of course includes you, our listeners, over the years. For this special episode, I was delighted to welcome back Dr. Jean Watson, who was the first guest on Being Human back in June 2020, as we discussed the importance of understanding and learning the value of emotions and what they have to teach us. Jean is someone close to my heart as a mentor, supervisor, and guide in my own journey as a clinical psychologist. As a co-developer of emotion-focused therapy alongside with Dr. Leslie Greenberg and Dr. Robert Elliott, Jean was supervised by Dr. Laura Rice, who worked with Carl Rogers and colleagues at the University of Chicago in the 1980s, and later worked on the precursor to EFT with Robert and Les. And Laura was described as a pioneer of psychotherapy process research and was known to instill in her students a solid foundation of empathy, non-judgment, and positive regard toward their clients. And this foundation is apparent to anyone who spends time with Jean, who is rightly herself acknowledged to be a master therapist. And much of what makes her a great therapist is her incisive ability to attune to and connect with the people she works with and her unwavering commitment to seeing their potential for growing into the person they want to become. In this conversation with Jean, I was keen to find out what attracted Jean to the field, so I began by asking her about her early days as a psychologist and her experience being guided and supervised by Laura Rice.
I was extremely fortunate. First of all, I had come from South Africa. I had a degree in political studies and English literature. I had thought that I might go on to do law. Because in South Africa, given the political situation at the time, it attending to people's psyches when they didn't have civil liberties, food, they were being oppressed as they were, didn't seem that relevant socially, right? However, I met the person who became my husband. And he actually had been in school, was about to graduate, at which point you were able to delay going to the army in South Africa. Men went to the army in South Africa under the apartheid regime. But you could delay while you were in school, i.e. university, after which point, once you graduated, you were conscripted in. And you could, if you refused to go, the other option was to go to jail until you agreed to go. So it wasn't that you served a term in jail. Anyway, he decided he wanted to leave. So we thought we left South Africa, and his parents had applied to immigrate here to Canada. So we came to Canada, and for a number of years, we had to deal with immigration. We didn't come with papers. That was an interesting 3-year period. And in the meantime, while here, I was still, we had a business, but I was still wondering what I would do with the rest of my life. I didn't see being in business fully satisfying for me, and was wondering about law again here. I thought about social work, and I think reading. I think it was Simone de Beauvoir's The Mandarins. There's a psychotherapist in that. And there was something about reading that book one afternoon. It just dawned on me, I could do that. You know, what the psychotherapist was doing. That just suddenly...
It's a good thing there wasn't a detective in that. You know, Jean, you might have been a homicide detective.
It's funny, Laura Rice used to like detective stories. And in some ways... That is one way of thinking a little bit about what we do, but it's not the perfect metaphor. But it was just sort of a light bulb moment. So then I went about exploring how I would do that in a Canadian context, what was required, and but interestingly, in spite of not wanting to be in business, I also considered doing an MBA, right? Because I didn't want to move away. So I could only apply to a few schools. You know, our life was in Toronto. So I didn't feel free to go to other places. So if I was, you know, going to further my education to be in Toronto, I could either do an MBA. And I thought, you know, there'd be sort of organizational psychology. Because, you know, the chances of getting into graduate school in psychology, especially if you're only applying to one or two places, is very small, right? So given the probabilities, I thought I should kind of have an alternative. So I actually applied to both and got accepted to both, but chose psychology because Laura offered me a position. I mean, psychology was something, the thing I really wanted to do, pursue. And I got to work with Laura Rice. I think I was one of her last students before she retired as I went into my doctorate a few years in. But and at that time she was working on systematic evocative unfolding. She was doing the task analysis of that. She had worked with Les and he'd done the work on the Gestalt techniques, and had gone off to UBC. So when I came to York, and for some reason in an undergraduate counseling class that I took with Laura, she introduced the students to systematic evocative unfolding, and it just always made such sense to me. I have subsequently seen students struggle with it, but it just seemed natural to me. And I don't know why. The sense of looking for a trigger and the understanding how a person construes events and their interpretation.
Like the process of it was natural.
Just totally natural. You know, I just remember that sense when we did it in an in vivo group. Oh, wow, this is so cool. So she was working on that. And I came in as a master's student and I did my master's work also on systematic evocative unfolding, doing a first kind of verification study, a very exploratory kind of very, very small study, you know, verifying the steps of the model with the various process measures and, you know, collecting data too, because we were therapists. And at that time, Robert Elliott was coming up to Toronto to work with Laura to learn systematic evocative unfolding. And so we were, you know, practicing on each other. And, you know, I sort of really came in at ground level. And then at that point, Les came back to Toronto too. He moved back to York from UBC. And he and Laura started working on facilitating emotional change and invited Robert to be part of the group. So that was, they began to articulate what came to be known as process experiential therapy, right? Which just included all the tasks, particularly the gestalt ones, two chair, empty chair, systematic evocative unfolding, and of course, you know, the client-centered kind of responding and conditions. And Laura had was also writing about the vulnerability marker and using empathy at moments of vulnerability and how to resolve it, right? But that wasn't as clearly articulated as some of the other performance models. So they both articulated their research paradigm, which they had been working on and presenting at SPR for, you know, since the late 70s through the 80s, right? This really made a lot of sense.
Was Laura's work your first exposure to what a psychotherapist looked like?
I had actually seen a therapist in Johannesburg before I left. So I had done some personal work with a therapist. I remember when I was in the undergraduate doing some makeup courses, because I had to do makeup courses before I could go apply to graduate school. I did a lot of reading around, you know, and various theories spoke to me. And I also worked at a behavioral therapy clinic here in Toronto as a volunteer. I wasn't paid, which used desensitization and I think Ellis type rational emotive therapy for the treatment of agoraphobia. So initially I was kind of also interested in REBT and Meichenbaum's, you know, cognitive therapy, the self-talk, but also Horney. I was doing quite a bit of reading in Mahler and symbiosis. And so some of those dynamic theories spoke to me. Kind of classical analysis didn't ever really, as a theoretical approach, you know, didn't resonate for some reason in terms of the theoretical framework of the world. Anyway, so Harry Stack Sullivan too seemed important. You know, I resonated to a lot of his ideas, and a lot of the family therapists, the systems. But that happened through graduate school, kind of the systemic perspectives and Murray Brown and sort of thinking of things from a more family perspective. But right at the beginning, it was the opportunity to work with Rice and doing, an undergraduate course where she taught client-centered therapy, right? And that made a lot of sense to me, because as a child with a very disturbed mother whom I tried to counsel, or did spend my childhood counseling and trying to support and provide suggestions, and watching how, I suppose it was watching ultimately her do what she wanted or not take reasonable routes. It felt like very early on I realized, I was kind of primed, that advice giving doesn't work. Right, there's got to be another way to work with the person. So something that's still very hard for my students, you know, and still sometimes for me as a parent or in other roles and relationships in my life, to sort of quell the need to offer advice or suggestions or point a way. In psychotherapy, it'd make perfect sense that wasn't the route to support growth and healing. So that spoke to me. That was nothing I had to fight. And again, the way of working in a Rogerian way also just fit. Made perfect sense to reflect as opposed to ask questions. I could still get information and direct using reflections. So there was just something about the whole approach that kind of somehow clicked or fit for me.
As an aside, and you've mentioned reading very widely and different theories of psychotherapy, and especially of like the older the older guys, which I feel like, you know, their work is very rich and very detailed. Like, I felt like they were true students of human nature, and it just spent their time. I imagine that they spent their time smoking and drinking and just staring at people do people things, you know, and discussing theories freely and then arguing with one another. I mean, they had many, many arguments. Today, I find that there are not that many students who love to read so widely. I'm not sure. Has that been your experience? And do you think that impacts them as a therapist? You know, how, maybe, I don't know. I mean, I'm using it sort of a cold work a word, but like their efficacy as a therapist, or maybe just their connection. You know, do you think it helps to be a better therapist if one reads widely and is informed by different, I guess, opinions and perspectives of human nature?
I guess it's important for anyone in the pursuit of wisdom to kind of read widely. You know, my first degree was in English literature, which, you know, is very much about exploring the human condition, the psyche, as you know, as well as literary technique and method, etc. But, you know, in a way, I also have to, if I'm honest, part of the reading widely was also my search for self-understanding and to make sense of what had happened to me, my life experience. So, you know, there was a fire that propelled it, right? I guess it also became the referent in terms of what made sense of my experience too, in terms of what seemed valuable to me. And yes, I don't know if it's just our students, but I don't think our education systems encourage, certainly in North America, wide reading. You know, to encourage students to read widely or present theories in the same way that perhaps we did in previously. And in fact, the field of psychology is quite disappointing in the way that it feels like it's become really narrow, and that narrowness is justified by a science that has been used in some ways to delegitimize different approaches. I mean, so, you know, really the training, unfortunately, is purely CBT, and students don't feel, I mean, they have to actively seek out alternatives, whether it be psychodynamic or, you know, more humanistic approaches. But our field doesn't proliferate, especially in psychology, I've noticed, because we also train at OISE a group of psychotherapists who don't have psychologists as supervisors and are in the field. And in the field, there are a lot of different types of other approaches that are offered, like internal family systems is very big right now. And of course, these flavors, different flavors, right? But certainly the psychologists, the students that I'm training are CBT, ACT, DBT, and they seem to have difficulty straying from that path. So it feels very constraining. So no, I don't feel they read as widely. I don't think there is a kind of a question of how do we understand people? What really motivates people? Who am I? How does that relate to the world at large? We have all these rules, right, including around social justice concerns and there's scripts. It feels like everything's very scripted.
I remember you once asked me this question of like, why am I studying EFT? And you know, as my supervisor and you know, my way of learning is also to ask many questions. And I can't remember what I said, but I think to the effect of, I like learning about people, and like to me, EFT is a great therapy, and there's research to it, and it's approaching, you know, the understanding of a person from one perspective. And then, yeah, the CBT is also another useful perspective, but it's also one single approach. I think the older psychologists, psychiatrists, psychodynamic therapists, however they term themselves, just students of human nature, it's not always easy to read their writings. I mean, it's sometimes really complex. But there are many moments where I am reading it and I yell to my mom, "Mom, they had such foresight. You know, they really, you know, we're still, it's as if their insights are fresh today. We're still struggling and discovering, quote unquote, discovering the things that they talked about years and years ago, you know, and then we're like, as if the truths or the observations they made then only now are making its way through Instagram. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's as if people are like, "Oh yeah, that's so true. I can't believe someone." But actually, you know, it's really useful, I think, to, instead of like limiting yourself to just go, "I'm just going to learn one therapy," or "I'm going to learn a manual," to think about, if you want to effectively help people, then you have to learn people. You have to understand the uniqueness, but also the diversity, the commonalities, the shared humanity of people, and appreciate the different perspectives.
Absolutely. It's about people and the person in all their uniqueness.
I'm going to ask a question, then I'm going to say that's a dumb question because I already have the answer to that. So I'm going to ask the question, answer it, and I'm going to ask you a better question. The question originally was, do you think that EFT has changed since its early development? And of course, the answer is yes. So the next better question would be, how has it changed from then to now?
You want the short answer?
It's a long one. Just the long answer. Yeah.
It's fallen prey to manualization. I'm not quite sure how it happened. I wonder about it. Laura Rice was very committed to calling it process experiential therapy. So she knew the focus was on process and being responsive moment to process. And she saw it as experiential because she saw deeply rooted in the theory of Rogers and probably Gendlin, although, you know, I have to go back historically and look at what the overlap is between them. But clearly, Gendlin was very much involved in Rogers' personality theory. From my perspective, Rogers' personality theory got lost and has been totally overshadowed by the relationship conditions. That Rogers is empathy and relationship conditions, right? But he had a very simple, but somewhat sophisticated, from my perspective, personality theory, which of course Gendlin in his work goes on to articulate further. But Gendlin didn't publish his work until very late, primarily because he was anti-establishment and he was very ecumenical in his goals and objectives. So, I mean, the process model, which is his dissertation, it took a long time. Anyway, so those ideas didn't percolate, right? But the focus on organismic experiencing and the trust in the natural evolution and growth tendency of the organism is very central to the approach, right? Especially, you know, the experiential approach. So one of the biggest shifts, and the organismic experience encompasses more than just emotions, right? So one of the biggest shifts happened early on with the shift, calling it emotion-focused therapy, which Rice never wanted. She was quite opposed to that. But when she retired and and then passed away, there was the shift to called emotion focus therapy as a way to kind of brand it in the United States as an alternative to CBT. There was also the growing popularity of emotionally focused therapy. Sue Johnson, I think, had gained a lot of traction in the couples therapy world. But there was a thought of kind of leveraging all of that, you know. So then there was became more and more in the theory and in the approach, this emphasis on emotion as central to the process. And then, of course, you know, there was the shift into emotion types and using the different techniques with different client populations, and, you know, resulted in sort of tweaks and kind of highlighted different understandings. And then, of course, it was a lot more research. So the researcher began to inform it more, and various models that evolved from research emerged, and different models were sort of constructed around pain, like an Antonio's model. So in that sense, it has evolved very much, right?
There was a moment where you said manualization in a less positive way. And so do you feel that manualizing, I'm not sure that all our listeners know what manualizing is. And so maybe you can elaborate on what happens and why you think that's not necessarily a positive development.
It's not positive development, because at some level, manualization is an attempt to provide structured teaching materials, to make something clearer, to shine a light on a process and kind of identify the steps involved. So the intent to do that, which, you know, Gendlin had when he identified the steps of focusing, Rice had when she identified systematic evocative unfolding as a way of working with problematic reactions. You know, Liz did with Perls's techniques, the two-chair dialogue and the unfinished dialogue. You know, they're very useful ways of trying to articulate, simplify, distill the essence of something that looks very complex and messy from the outside. However, when we begin to impose that kind of very linear, sequential framework on a process that actually is much more fluid, is messy by definition, what happens is they begin to constrain people and what they see and what is seen as acceptable, because they want to follow a certain map. It's just like any framework begins to limit what is admissible or can be seen within it, right? I mean, it goes for any theory, any worldview, any. And I feel the people who come to EFT now, many are drawn by the manualization and feel really constrained within the model. And it's very funny too, because for many decades, there was never much talk about countertransference and transference issues in humanistic Rogerian literature. And, you know, in my practice, I don't think this was just a theoretical blindness, but I think there is a way that we work in a client-centered Rogerian way that kind of provides a guard against those processes. Not entirely, you know, especially if you're working with people long-term, you know, our own issues and stuff is, you know, there are going to be collisions, but the way of working kind of can minimize impact. So there was no need, I suppose, wasn't on the radar. But more recently, more and more EFT therapists are complaining of client resistance and what do you do when it doesn't work in a kind of frustrated sense, right? And that seems to me to be a function of the manualization of the of them being attached to a particular kind of process and not having the capacity to be more responsive, more fluid, to trust the process, right? I mean, so there's that, you know, there's the fundamental kind of principle in humanistic therapies of trusting the client's capacity to grow, change, evolve, and how to support and access that with them, you know, to provide the scaffolding or the support for that to emerge that feels like it gets lost with manualization because you have a sense of, oh, we just have to move someone from A to Z and then it'll be fine. And that may not be the case. And you've also got to, you know, maybe the techniques aren't the ones that work for this particular case at this particular time. You know, you've just got to change tack and be a little bit more creative, right? Or do something different. Does that make sense? So that's
I had the same thought in my mind when you were talking about it. So if you used the word resistance, which is the proper term. And in my head, I was like, oh, yeah, the rebellious client, right? Because this client is not following, it's not complying to what's written on the page. You know, you're supposed to go from this, and if I say that, then you do that. And I remember, especially in my EFT training, I was never the compliant client. As much as I want compliant clients, but as a client, I am not compliant. And you know, you were the trainer for these workshops, and I felt quite badly for my fellow trainees who were practicing on me, and their complaint about me was like, "She's too cognitive." You know, where are the emotions? But what it did was it made me feel so bad about being a thinking person, right? As if I just had to emote and I couldn't. And because I was failing to emote in the way that they understood. Because I was emoting, but in my way, and it may not have, it's not put on. It's authentic to who I am, which probably for some people may seem muted, but I think it is there. But they were quite frustrated with me. And as a client, even though I was just practicing, the demand characteristics, right? And then feeling bad and somehow shameful that, okay, this person is clearly being frustrated with me. And then to be labeled resisting or the rebellious client, you know, as if now I've come to you for help. And I am then wronged, you know, because I've now done something wrong by just being me, you know. And that's been something that kind of always, I guess, stuck with me on how, ironically, in a therapy that's supposed to teach you empathy and being with a person and entering a person's world, that it's not always empathic, you know, especially when, you know, yeah.
Precisely. So there's, you know, when I hear you describe it like that, the way I see it is this, they lose the touchstone of empathy because empathy directs you to go back to the client, to track and follow the client, which of course is the best counter to any resistance or that you experience, right? So, of course, there's always a struggle to balance who's the agent in the room, right? And it's very, very hard for us as human beings to allow the other person to be the agent.
There was this moment, and, you know, I was talking to you about a client, and she had some difficulties doing some of her tasks and the work that she had to do in her real life. And you said, well, you can just use behavioral therapy. And I was like, what? I felt suddenly so permitted not to be locked in. Because clearly, as you know, as you're saying, right, it's not always the fit, right? And we have to be flexible. And if this person is lacking the skills to do what they need to do, getting in touch with the emotion at that point in time is not the most helpful thing if they need to just do what they need to do. And I think that's sometimes a danger about being too in love with a particular therapy that, you know, by hook or by crook, like this is, we must tackle every single problem with just this therapy. And it, again, it fails to see the person for who the person is, and that this may not be suitable for their needs. I mean, looking back, it's sort of silly, but it was very freeing for me because all of a sudden I was like, oh, thank God, I don't have to lock away my other skills. I can still bring it in.
Right.
There was this moment in last year, I think I was talking to my therapist, and I told him that, you know, sometimes when I don't want to think always about my illness, right? And he's been ill before, and I was telling him, you know, I don't always want to think about my illness. And I was like, does that mean I'm avoiding? And is that bad? And, you know, in therapy speak, avoidance is bad. And I think there's something about maybe, and that's where you're with the wisdom, you know, being exposed to different and wiser therapists is also helpful, as well as you going through your own experiences. And then he said, well, of course, you don't want to think about it all the time. And, you know, so I think if we just start, if we're narrow with maybe even just, yeah, as much as I love research and you do a lot of research too, if we just take certain things and go, okay, it's black or white, right? Like avoidance is bad. You can never avoid, no matter what. We become very narrow people, even in our own experience. Like, how are we to adapt? You know, if I always have to think about my grief, if I always have to think about my illness, is there no space for me to do some sort of, I don't know, can I call it adaptive avoiding?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think of seeing avoidance is bad. It is a very adaptive coping skill. It becomes problematic if it's causing other problems that maybe need attention, right? But not in itself. It's a wonderful skill that we have as human beings to be able to shut out aspects of experience that are too distressing. We use it all the time, right?
Perhaps, you know, sort of the downside of the manualization is we learn how to just deal with problems, right? I mean, essentially, manuals are specific routes, and we're not seeing the person in their own context and
their own complexity and willing to explore that, right? I mean, so there's a curiosity that gets dampened too, like the curiosity you spoke about at the beginning, which is so vital to the whole process, is also a very, Chandran calls it unit model, but, you know, there is a way of thinking that is very linear and rational, and especially in younger therapists, and sometimes with the manualization too, this expectation that everything is formed, it's just there to be taken out, right? Or so, you know, the therapist is like, I ask them what they feel, they don't know this, so what's the problem? You know, so there isn't a full appreciation of how much of our understanding, our experience actually gets constructed in the process of expressing it. I mean, you yourself said it with writing, right? It's hard for you to speak, but you can form your thoughts when you write. I think it's probably easier for us to speak with an audience, right? So in that sense, it's easier for me to have to formulate thoughts for you to kind of share them with you. But each time I don't know what that thought is that I'm going to express, right? It comes into being in the expression. And that's so much of what psychotherapy is the discovery. The person discovers too, because of your curiosity, your presence, your intent to listen and really hear, discover what is happening inside, right? And it's not there necessarily fully formed. It forms as we speak. And in addition, there probably are some skills, some capacities that have to be formed, that may not have had the opportunity to evolve and develop fully as a result of life experience, right? So, you know, I'm thinking about, just as we're talking, labels for emotions, or just recognizing emotions. Some people may not have the capacity for that. It may be physiological, it may be psychological. You know, we have to make the distinction, somehow beginning to differentiate among different sensations, right? Which is so much part of the physical versus psychological, right? And sometimes that's what's required with an I don't know. Sometimes an I don't know is just a disengaged, not going there kind of response, right? And we have to figure that out. But
I had a thought, and okay, yeah, no, it came back for a moment. I was like, I had a thought that just, there was this, the thing that you talked about of co-discovery. And so one of the questions I guess I often get is, why do we even need a therapist, right? Why can't I just sort of journal it all down? And of course, if you journal it all down and it helps, then yes, actually, you don't need therapy. And I believe not everyone needs therapy. I think therapy can be tremendously helpful for most people, but a need, like maybe you don't need it, you know, in that sense. But going back to what I said at the beginning, was your intensity of that co-discovery is you get someone who is so interested in understanding and trying to figure out your experience for you somehow makes it come out easier. It's not just you're not passively waiting. If I can describe it for our listeners, it's almost like you are at the edge of your seat, you, the listener, edge of your seat, and you're like nodding your head. And if you could, you would have a gentle, but it's a hook, but a gentle hook to help the words come out. And so there's almost that energy there, right? Because it's not passive and it's gentle because, you know, you're not forcing it out, but it is that, you know, I guess a little bit of that pull and energy that the exploring is inward, but yet outward at the same time. I don't think my words are that great, but I'm trying to put into words what the process at least feels for me for having someone who's co-discovering with me as compared to me journaling it down and being mostly in my head, you know?
Yes, it is. I mean, you know, I think you put that beautifully, but there's some other aspect to the saying it in words. But I think the journal process formalizes too much. And unless you're really doing kind of expressive writing and putting defensive and guards on hold. So if you're writing like that, I think there's an equivalent intensity to psychotherapy. But it's also being done without the supports if you happen upon pretty vulnerable material. So having a witness who's prepared to hold and support the process of discovery can be very helpful. Having done expressive writing, using take all the breaks off and experiencing how powerful it is, but then having it only passively heard, quite hard. I mean, I did it during the grief work. So, you know, my work that I was doing, and I think it would have been much easier to have it really heard and understood by someone else, and a sense of kind of empathy would have softened whatever that experience was, all those emotions that were kind of evoked. But what I want to say about this process of discovery is, like, in finding the words, if a person can allow themselves to speak freely, the way they choose to express something can resonate and call up an experience that's relevant, right? I wish I had an example, but I'm so keenly aware of that I mean, it's why it may be lovely when you see someone move into focused voice, because they're letting some of the defenses down. And, you know, if someone talks about how they construe something in the world, the word they use can be, oh, right, it's about my relation with my mother, or, oh, the way I've said that, that ties into this, right? But so that's the looking and the hearing, the idiosyncratic language, and the capacity of both the therapist and the client to resonate to it. So it can be, you know, when you talk about clients being cognitive, or I suppose what we mean in experiential work, when we talk about being externalizing, people are keeping within a very specific range. Whereas if we can let some of that down and allow experience to emerge freshly, unscripted, it can provide a lot of clues of what's important, where to look, the work that needs to be done. I'm actually botching this whole job of trying to explain what is a very kind of ephemeral.
I mean, I botched mine, so it's only fair you botched yours. No, but I think I caught a glimpse of it. The glimpse of almost the way we say it. Yes, the choice of words, but even if you have a limited vocabulary, actually, just the way you're saying it can further your internal experience and insight into what's happening, you know, and because then we also become a little bit, I guess, with someone else there. We're not just experiencing, we're also observing. You know what I mean? We're experiencing ourselves from as a person, but also experiencing ourselves as an other. Whereas often I think when I'm by myself, it's just sort of is not as multifaceted to experience myself. I don't really experience myself as an other or like, because I'm not really talking to someone else, right? So when words come out, I'm hearing it as myself, but I'm also hearing it as the therapist hears it, and then also can further my insight, you know, because I'm that's what I mean. I'm hearing it by the other, and the more I talk, the more I feel like I'm botching it up. So your nodding is encouraging me to like, okay, you get what I mean. And I think often, and we have to wrap up soon, but this idea that what saddens me, or maybe sadden isn't the right word. I think what I'm generally, as you know, I'm an irritated person. I'm irritable and not so much sad. What irritates me is how we keep wanting to simplify human connection and psychotherapy, right? We keep wanting and just another app to capture it, or program just an AI to just do everything, and as if like it could be so it's so reductionistic, you know, as if this a deep connection that even you and I without are struggling to capture could be simplified. And even if it could, we lose the richness. You know, even if we could have perfect words, we would lose the wealth of experience and just the richness of emotion and of thinking and of being, because now it's just ones and zeros. It's tremendously irritating as someone in public health, because I keep saying that's not how it works. But it worries me too, as an educator, to see how often our students want it quicker and simpler, and they just, you know, they want it predictable and certain. And it's, I don't know whether it's almost dehumanizing our experience, right?
Well, the reductionism does do that to some extent, which is problematic, you know, because it is a dominant paradigm.
Now, if you were a student,
yeah,
in 2023, looking for, I mean, you know, so if there was some sort of back to the future scenario, and you were looking to do grad school in the year 2023, do you think you'd be attracted to being a psychotherapist in its modern day form?
I think I'd be attracted to being a psychotherapist. What's your question? Would I still do this work?
Yeah. Would you be a CBT therapist? I don't know. Would you just
I'd be a CBT therapist? I couldn't be a CBT therapist.
Never.
Funny. You know, I recently listened to, I think it was something on YouTube by Albert Ellis. I think it was, you know, some talk about looking back on his career, and, you know, I really understood him, and I, you know, and I listened to his tapes, and, you know, I was always very aware that although he does most of the talking, he really gets his clients. Okay, but, you know, maybe it's a personal truth. It was never just about the self-talk for me. For me, you know, I'm one of those people of, I need to process what's going on. Don't just tell me to think differently about something. So that is so important to me.
But in itself, you know, it's quite scary.
I feel blind with the CBT protocol. I feel so, you know, I mean, I could I learn to follow one? Yeah, I suppose I could, but I can't, you know, I think very laterally. Rice always said that you know, she did too. It's like, so being that linear is just not, is antithetical to my way of being. You know, my curiosity and the way I think laterally, I'm much happier in kind of intuitive, messy process, right? Being responsive in the moment is kind of what I see as important. And of course, you know, from my writings, I do see the kind of that the importance of presence and empathy. But, you know, even late in my career, I've come to, you know, that an empathic reflection is a wonderfully, looks simple, it looks idiotic, but it's the most wonderfully complex way of responding to another person, and is so multifunctional, and also facilitates what I talked about earlier in terms of therapist experience in the moment. Because just as in any active listening dialogue, if you see it in couples, it allows that moment of processing for both people. I've never emphasized as much until latterly, or saw it in that light. It allows me to process what you've said. It actually buys me time. So I'm not just always reacting to the person, right? I've actually formulated something, gives me time to think about it and what my next response might be, and then watch for what comes back, right? So that's a safeguard against the kind of transference a little bit. So it provides a little bit of a buffer, right? And it gives me the extra processing time. As well, of course, it's important for their processing and facilitating these reflective skills in them. I mean, I'm trying to activate their own capacities to do what needs to do to change, which might be include activating memories. It might include activating feelings, emotions, understanding of the organism. But it's the most basic thing we can do. It's the hardest thing to have people see as powerful. Motivated by curiosity, it can be just bring forth so much. And in the bringing forth from the client, they get a chance to order it and see it and think about it and get support with what's painful, right? And I know that's part of what the work of psychotherapy is, right? So it facilitates the understanding, it facilitates the kind of processing of the emotions. It's good for the relationship because they feel they're with someone who's trying to understand, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a very hard little technique. I mean, it's such a workhorse. And a very, very hard technique because people have to give up what they see as control of the process or being the agent in the room. And yet, in the meantime, you are actually being really agentic if you're reflecting in a way that's really with the client and distilling what they're saying, right? And you're also augmenting, supporting their capacities.
This is some very beautiful process that you're describing, one that inevitably takes time. And, you know, just before we started, I was talking to you about how so many difficult experiences, I have to keep learning the same lesson that it's okay to take time, and it's okay to take time. the world keeps going on, even if you pause or even get out. You know, like, you can not reply emails at midnight. I've got very bad work-life balance, as you know. Or I could slow down my pace of work tremendously, and it's okay, you know. But the sentiment that I often hear with regards to therapy is like, how long will it take? And of course, people want to get better. And as I tell people, okay, I think by this number of sessions, you would feel a little bit better. But, you know, the process you're talking about is not just feeling better or, you know, like the symptomatic relief. You know, this all this, you refer to it as the organismic process or the growth. The person is growing to be fuller, I think, to be, you know, like, I mean, the word potential, but the potential seems sort of weak. And I think the rich experience of what our human growth actually is. But it seems that today's world has no time for it.
Well, we see things in terms of these macro outcomes, which is also why it's so hard to work in the moment in therapy, because people aren't able to distinguish just the micro, the very, very, not even micro, you know, the even smaller than micro shifts in the process, right? So to get them to look that closely, we're also focused on the macro outcome and some kind of implicit assumption that with that macro outcome, something is finished. There is a finished product. But actually what I'm suggesting is that it isn't about a macro outcome. Okay, yes, it is about not feeling depressed anymore and having a way to manage anxiety, but it's actually about maintaining a living process that actually continues to evolve subsequently, right? So it's not about finishing anything. Yes, it can be about alleviating certain states that are stuck, like depression, like anxiety, like behaviors that are inimical to our well-being and our thriving. But it's about more than that. It's also about cultivating a way of being for the organism to continue moving forward to thrive, right? And that's a very different framing in interaction with work. It's a different framing, it feels to me, from the one that we impose in this very outcome-oriented, time-focused, produce world.
That even that we carry it even in therapy, right? Then that we have to produce something. Harry Stack Sullivan is one of my favorite psychiatrists. You know, he often talked about the problems his patients had in living. And these were patients with very serious issues. You know, they were diagnosed with schizophrenia he actually dealt with patients with schizophrenia. But he would just describe them as problems in living. And it's sort of that, you know, what you said before resonated with that, you know, that it's about living and not just about a diagnosis or just the alleviation of depression or anxiety. And it's about helping people live and manage mm-hmm. the difficulties so that they can keep growing and moving, you know, that we're not stuck. Even when we are experiencing truly difficult circumstances. Well, thanks, Jean, for joining me on our podcast. It was a delightful conversation, as always.
Thank you so much. It's been so great to reconnect and see you again. And I always value that and appreciate it. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Being Human podcast. To find out more about Relate Malaysia's online therapy services, visit us at www.relate.com.my or email us at inquires@relate.com.my. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, remember, we are all more human than we are otherwise. Be kind to yourself and take care.